the reason that we have brought in so many different perspectives beyond just the sciences and technologies is because we really want to balance imaginative, creative, and speculative mode of expanding what's thinkable, expanding what can be imagined and executed with an awareness of the hard facts and the really concrete realities that we're confronting. It can be pretty overwhelming to think at the scale of planetarity, to think at the scale of multi-species existence, and it can be really hard emotionally to actually get yourself there without falling into despair.
Welcome to the Interspecies Future podcast. This is Kemrick Aledo McDowell, one of the Interspecies Future chairs, talking at the Interspecies Future Symposium that was held in Berlin in July 2022.
And this is why we need grounding in lifeways that have embodied interspecies relations as well as systems thinking. And this is why we also need the imaginative capacity of artists and creators to inspire us to see what's possible when it seems like not a lot is possible.
The Interspecies Future Symposium set out to mark the beginning of a multi-decade civilizational journey to define the interspecies discipline and set pathways to bend the evolution of AI towards nature.
As we talk about the power of AI, and it is a tremendously powerful tool, but will we be able to use that technology, the information it produces, to reach a shared vision of how we share the planet with the rest of the species?
The symposium, co-hosted by LAS and the Museum for Natterkunde in Berlin, explored state-of-the-art AI, robotics, sensing, biology, alongside panel discussions including artists, scientists, and technologists. In this episode, we're hearing highlights from the Interspecies Future Symposium. The discussions were framed around what we see as the core capabilities for the interspecies future. Thinking.
We have to come over a challenge, which is the main thing our conscious minds is for, is language and creating social behavior.
Sensing.
For the first time, you give the oil birds the voice to tell you, what are you really doing?
Imagining.
I think in terms of looking into intelligence and our search for intelligence in what we're doing, there are intelligences everywhere. They are real.
And organizing.
In the coming days, the gathering of future-oriented researchers, scientists, artists, and thought-leading organizations, this symposium is an experiment to collectively explore an interspecies future and to subsequently define the thinking, discourse, and action.
The first panel of the day, Thinking, was moderated by Kemrick Aledo McDowell. The panel reflected on how AI can be a tool for interspecies work. Empathy, trust, and shared values were also key points that emerged from Ted Schmidt of the Allen Institute for AI. We join the panel as Kemrick poses a question to Ted concerning the practical challenges of implicating technology.
Ted, I think you'll be able to speak very concretely to what it means to try to realize these efforts. Because when I listen to you speak about these projects that you've worked on, and one example I heard you talk about was sending radios that were held in customs for 9 months, and then the group was charged storage fees for 9 months after they were held, and then you kind of deployed them, and of course there was training involved. And so we're talking about radios, we're not talking about gigabit internet, we're not talking about...
Talking about 1970s technology, yeah. I always start by, we technologists love our technology, and we love to think about what we can solve with the technology, but I think at the end of the day we have to remember it's just a tool. It can be an incredibly powerful tool. AI will be even more of an incredibly powerful tool. But there is the reality of what we do with that technology, and that's a lot about values and how we value things. I think maybe if I give an example. So in Botswana, where a very large percentage of Africa's savanna elephants live now. We were able to map the corridors and how elephants use these corridors. They tend to move from one area to another by using a corridor. We could map that using the technology. And that's really powerful information. But I was out on the ground and we went and visited a number of the villages. And I'll remember for the rest of my life, this lady saying to me, in her native language translated, "I want to kill all the elephants. I want them all dead." So why did she say that? Well, it turned out her niece had been killed 2 years before by an elephant. And the last year, her entire her family's entire crop that was their living and their food source was destroyed by elephants. So that was her value was, these elephants are just destructive. They're killers. I want them gone. And so, you know, how do we help that person with the technology? And the project actually we're working on was to come up with land use plans that were using the knowledge we gained by how the elephants use that space and those corridors to convince these villagers to avoid putting their crops in those areas and putting them in other areas. Very powerful use of the technology. But what's also involved there is trust. So do they trust us to tell them where to put their crops? Do we have another agenda? So we have to build those trust relationships to use the knowledge of that technology to convince them, one, that we want to help these people as well as the elephants, that we don't care about the elephants. And I've heard that actually many times. You care more about these animals than you do about us. So how do we not just get enamored with the technology and get excited about what it can tell us, but how do we get others who need to act on that information? How do we build the trust relationships? That empathy is so incredibly important. I think the technology will help us understand what new science and new engineering approaches. We can engineer solutions, but we have to build the empathy to be able to build those relationships to use the technology. I always like to go back to thinking about what do I envision? What is my theory of change? What is the outcome I want? And that's a really hard question. We can apply the AI and the technology to help us get to that place, but do we share what that place is? So as we talk about the power of AI, and it is a tremendously powerful tool, but will we be able to use that technology, the information it produces, to reach a shared vision of how we share the planet with the rest of the species?
I want to come back first to this thing about the value of the animals to the people there. And when we're sitting here and having these reasonings, I was just in Amsterdam for a weird AI and people meeting too. And it was, they've done so much effort. You know, we all know that they went from having like, you know, car hell, just like New York City in Amsterdam in the 70s to this beautiful, bike, co-sharing bike thing. Well, now they've done all the stuff the British have been talking about. They've put all these flowers everywhere. It's all wildflowers, bee heaven. There's no insects. It's like, you know, there's no birds except for like ducks and seagulls, and there's no insects except for a few bees. And we're sitting here talking about you need to have elephants in your front yard, and we like spray all the mosquitoes, right? Where are our buffalo? How much of America are we going to put back into buffalo? Let's solve that problem first, and let's lead by demonstration, you know? Yeah. Trying to get the wolves back into Austria. You know, they come every so often hungry or whatever, and people shoot them, right? So we need to be leading, and we need to not only be projecting. But anyway, sorry, slight digression there. But more into the AI thing, I don't think it makes sense to think about AI entities as peers. I do think that artificial intelligence is absolutely artificial, because what I mean by artificial is that it's an artifact. It is something that we've chosen to build that is an extension of us and our intelligence and for which we have responsibility. And animals, on the contrast, are siblings. You know, they're things that have evolved. The pattern is there. Even if we, you know, biomanipulate them a little, the fundamental pattern, we have like 87% of the same genes as fruit flies, right? You know, so the fundamental pattern is not something that was subject to our conscious decisions. one of the things, if we're trying to get empathy with the rest of nature, we have to come over a challenge, which is the main thing our conscious minds is for, is language and creating social behavior. And one of the fundamental sort of algorithms of that is the in-group, out-group thing. And so when we hear language, we think, wow, that's me, especially if it matches up to your language and it can talk to you, it can translate between the languages you know, and it can talk to you about your favorite sports teams, and it can discuss, you know, it can sing the songs you like. That is, in another human, an indication of massive lifetime investment in the same things you were invested in. And so we are fooled, and we are programmed to be fooled at a fundamental level by machines. So if we can help get over that hurdle, if we can do things that expose how that is working, then I think that's going to push us into a much more empathetic space with the rest of society. I mean, the rest of animal society, sorry. It isn't going to be like, you know, Dr. Doolittle. It isn't that these animals are not as hypersocial as we are, and they're not going to have as much to say and as much art to express and whatever else. So I do think we are going to have to, we need to be a bit anthropocentric because we are animals, specifically because we are humans. We need to worry about our human culture, but I do think we want to figure out a way to facilitate these other expressions of our biology. Yeah.
Thank you, Joanna, so much for that. I want to do a little Q&A, and if you have some thoughts, so, you know, this is your permission to ask, to give a comment rather than a question, but also questions are welcome.
I have just one clarification question. Like, I love this concept of planetary compute or planetary computation. Can you elaborate a little more what that means or what that could look like, what the infrastructure could be? That would be super helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just speak to how I'm using that term, and I invite others to do so. It's a little vague, right? I think for me, what is in this context of this conference, we're talking about distributed computation, things like blockchain, but also sensory, planetary sensing as an important component. And then, of course, the way that technologies like AI are constructed at a planetary scale across the world. But if others have other definitions, I think this is an important thing to be somewhat precise about, because it's a bit of a buzzword, I think.
So for me, we haven't mentioned Internet of Things, but this micro-sensing. Imagine sensors everywhere on the planet that can tell you the hydrology level, pH level, movement of animals, movement of vehicles, everything all the time, and being able to process that using AI techniques to tell you exactly what's going on, where is climate change, you know, starting to have an impact. To me, that's what I mean by planetary sensing, is that we could have a very temporal and spatial granularity that we can't really imagine. Well, some of us have maybe imagined it, that would give us the ability to make decisions. Now, what decisions we make go back to our values and all of those things. But that's what I mean, is that you spatial and temporal granularity at a, you know, at the level where we could really deeply understand everything going on in the planet.
Thank you. That is awesome. You know, it makes planetary computation an infrastructure project like Cerebra is a perfect example. And then the planetary unfolds beyond the nature technology distinction, and we're in this terrain where, you know, you don't know planetary systems without compute or AI, and how to get into that space and how to build the infrastructure is like one of the key fascinating questions.
In the sensing panel, we explored the tech and the data from the microbial to the satellite technologies.
And they tell you about their universe. And that's what we want to give back to people.
What it really opened up my eyes to was like really how animals, their modes of sensing and their capacities for sensing are so different.
Martin Wachelski, director of the Max Planck Institute for Human Behavior, echoed the need for empathy and the importance of democratizing the data that's being gathered on the non-human world for the benefit of all species. MIT PhD candidate Pratyushka Sharma highlighted that our understandings of animals must remain particular to their individual environments, and this must be carefully considered at each moment of data capture and analysis. Here we join Jonathan as he asks Martin to explain the scope of his work, before we hear more from Petrucia about her work with sperm whales.
I think one of the things I find very fascinating about your work is that humans, we're not very good at thinking about how animals or non-humans in general move as groups through the world. Like, you are now really on the cutting edge in terms of scale, you know, operating from space, but then also a microchip on a hummingbird. So I just want to give you the chance, Martin, just to give a quick overview of your work, and then we will sort of unpack how it's changed over your career and, you know, where we might be going.
Well, thanks a lot. I think I want to go back to the motivation of where we come from, and that is we want to protect animals and contribute from the science part. Now, how can we do that? I think the key is that we need to democratize the information, give it back to the people that really are in contact with animals every day. And that's what Ted said before, this lady who really hates elephants. The idea for us was, well, how can we make animals relevant to people? Because that's the only way to do it. Now, your dog, your cat, your parrot, you will never kill because they give you something. You have empathy, they have empathy for you. How can we have that for wild animals? And that's because that's what we need globally. And we think the idea is to give animals a voice. But I think the key is they know something about the world that we don't. And especially this crazy metaphysical sixth sense of animals. A few years ago, everybody thought still, and they still look at me when I talk about it as if we are crazy. But I think the biologists, the ethologists, the animal behavior people in the past have not really looked at that, the interactions of animals. And I think that's a major, major, major lack of our knowledge. And I think it's good to have good old Humboldt here. Because he had that idea 200 years ago, but he also had major shortcomings in his observations of animals. I want to give you one. And that's really what triggered us 12 years ago, 14 years ago. So he went to Venezuela, the Humboldt Cave, oil birds. Now, oil birds were a special group of nightjars, and they realized they eat fruits. Now, obviously, they fly out of their cave. They live in caves, in this huge cave. There are about 15,000 in their cave. They fly out. They fly all night. They hover for fruit. They bring the fruit back in the cave. They drop the seeds. Seeds are dying there because there's no light. So they are parasites of the rainforest, right? Yeah. That was for 200 years. Then you put a tag on them. You give them, for the first time, you give the oil birds the voice to tell you, what are you really doing? So what are they doing is they fly out, they fly 100 kilometers to a specific tree because they love specific trees. They know exactly where that is, and they know it through their collective knowledge, not individual, but through their collection. Then they get a few fruit. They fly about a kilometer or so to their favorite tree to hang out. They spit the seeds out. They do it again and again and again and again. And they don't fly back to the cave that night. They stay in the forest and fly about 50 kilometers, spit out the seeds. And they do that for 2 nights, and then they come back to the cave and feed their young. So what happened, just by observing them once with an electronic tag, giving them the voice to tell us what they're doing, they have become the major seed dispersers in the Amazon. They are the most important in really keeping biodiversity over long scales, large scales, and they are joining the fruit bats in Africa and others and the elephants. And they tell you about their universe. And that's what we want to give back to people. And I think it's the same thing with the elephants. If you give the power of knowing what these elephants are doing to this person, she gets a tag. I mean, these are the little tags that we have. Just want to hand them around because they're already, I mean, they're new and good and exciting, but they're already dinosaurs. The next ones are much smaller. So So what we want to do is that these things just cost a few bucks. You give it to people, and this lady puts up like a spider web where the elephant comes. And the elephant is tagged, maybe only for 3 days until he removes the glue. And then you can see for 3 or 4 days exactly what they're doing, and they can tell you. And then they don't even know that they tell you. I mean, it's a really good situation, I think. And this is what, if you combine that information in a global system that people can access, so it's not something that is peculiar to scientists in the first world countries, but everybody can do that. Everybody can look at that. The people that are in contact with these elephants, they understand what they tell them, and they can react to them and interact with them. And I think that's what this, what we call the Internet of Animals, is all about. It's a democratized view of novel information about the world, of interaction of sensors that gives you a sixth sense of what's happening in the world, but on a global scale.
I'd love to introduce Pratyusha, who is a PhD student at MIT. You've been working extensively on sensor systems and computational language solutions for the sperm whale. So I wondered if you could just introduce your work a little bit, and then we can sort of dig into the question of when we talk about sense, we talk about feeling, but sense has this other meaning in English, which is literally to comprehend, you know, to make sense of something.
Okay, so thank you so much. Yeah, so so I come from a robotics and natural language processing background, that's what I'm doing my PhD in. So this project that John just mentioned about, it's called Project SETI. So the problem that's really of interest here is that we have a bunch of audio data recordings of whales that are tagged, and also a lot of other kinds of data of their behavior, sparse data of how they interact with one another. And the challenge really is that how do you figure out what are the smallest set of meaning-carrying units of their communication system? So I think what it really opened up my eyes to was like really how animals evolve in very, very different environments, right? Every animal evolves in a very niche environment with very different requirements. Some things are, of course, shared, like the need for reproduction, the need for food, but their modes of sensing and their capacities for sensing are so different. Like particularly in sperm whales, there were several different things that were of interest. So one thing that was of major interest was a lot of their communication is purely acoustic, because underwater light is after like 20, 30 meters, light is almost non-existent and sound becomes a major mode of sensing. So it was very interesting to see how they use sound to both like maybe communicate, but also like build a picture of the world via echolocation. Earlier, the communication of sperm whales, the smallest set of units that carry any kind of meaning was thought of as like the set of clicks called codas. And the complexity, if you were to go off the set of minimal units, was, let's say, some value X, right? So I think in the course of our study, we realized how, in fact, the variation that was previously thought of as noise very heavily correlated with changes in their behavior. So what it turned out to be the case was that like these minute variations, which might have been like if I say the word apple, or if I say apple, or like five different ways of saying apple, so it maps to still like the meaning of the word apple, right? But it turned out that these really, really small variations accumulated over time and caused very different behavior changes. So that was one of the things that we looked at, which I thought was fairly interesting about like how the complexity was heavily underestimated, and they might be able to pack in information in minuscule variations, which we might not have thought of as anything important. So the goal really with this project is once we have, there is a group of whales in Dominica, which we are interested in studying. And there's a wide array of sensor systems that we want to be able to use to measure different aspects of their daily life. So this could include the sounds that they're making, but also some notion of where they're moving, who they're talking to, and how these conversations or behaviors change over time. So on the robotic side, there is a drone, which is used to deploy the tags. Then there are these tags, which go on the whales. Then there are these floating microphones that can kind of follow around the whale, and also a robotic fish. And the idea with this is then, once we have all this data, which is still probably an incomplete version of the channels they use to communicate, how do we really make sense of this data? So earlier there was a mention of a large set of unsupervised learning techniques to kind of build predictive models over sets of symbols, like in the case of natural language words. But the interesting question here really is that how would we even know that we've come to the right set of words? Like, we don't have a ground truth for what is the correct solution. So I think that has been a really, like, how do we even evaluate the systems we build? Like, how do we know we've reached or finally found the system of communication? So we do build like several unsupervised learning, several models via like building predictive models over these vocalizations and behavior and try to link them both to one another. But like contrary to maybe what was discussed in the first panel, I think I'm not fully certain that machine learning models in their current state are capable of like discovering these meaning carrying units in this case, but also their ability to like discover things beyond what we have specified.
Sure. Yeah, of course, I can keep asking questions, but I would really like to open it up to the floor. Yes, please. Thank you.
Kind of a throwback to the last panel question and also a build off that, which is just, we talked a lot about shared values, but we talked about sharing values among our own species and the need to build those up. I don't know, for me, and this is in the spirit of half-formed thoughts, isn't the point here that we're hoping to open a window in some way to understand the values of species completely foreign to us, dissimilar, and the rest of life, and gain some understanding from that, not in a Dr. Doolittle way, not in a can we translate directly, but can we gain some opening, some understanding, and potentially shift our own values and our understanding of humans at the center or at the top of the tree, all of that.
Martin, maybe you can take that one.
Well, I would obviously fully agree with that, because if you have a group of cows telling you when the next earthquake is coming, or a group of goats when the next volcano is erupting, or a group of fruit bats where Ebola hides, then I think there is enormous value. And I think once people understand that, they realize there is so much knowledge, that this bio treasure that we have within the animal world, even just the large animal world, is absolutely amazing and outstanding, and they know a lot more than we know.
Yeah, that resonates. But I think the only thing in that that doesn't resonate totally is that we are only looking at it through the prism of what is valuable to us as human beings. And it feels like we need to broaden that dramatically.
An artist is an imaginer of worlds. Those worlds are based in an inner truth. Great art comes from the greatest inner truth, whatever that means.
The Imagining panel opened a freer territory for exploration in what is possible within the interspecies future, hearing from artists and cultural conduits in the field. It questioned everything we know about sensing and reminded us that we must think outside our own human perspectives. Gaming was discussed as a methodology for creating and navigating new worlds. And it was also highlighted that maybe we should think about what we shouldn't do in this space, as opposed to all the things that we should. In this excerpt, you'll hear from Elenda Chang, Robertina Sabianic, Ian Cheng, and our moderator, Kathleen Gray.
I'll briefly introduce myself. I'm Kathleen Gray. My orientation has always been through art and performance, through choreography, dance, and then in theater. And I worked collaboratively for 40 years with an interdisciplinary group, and we created a series of hands-on projects in different biomes. So it's the most famous project is Biosphere 2, which was a mini world built in the Arizona desert. It's 3-point-something acres, however many hectares, but it was like a bonsai earth with a mini ocean and desert and so on. And 8 people were sealed inside for 2 years. All the water and air and everything had to be recycled. These are people that were trained in theater, and in fact, the whole conception of Biosphere 2 was envisioned out of distinct artistic practices. And the purpose of that was to move the paradigm, or to add to ecology, give it a paradigm of laboratory science, because we knew what molecules were inside this complex system. And at the same time, it was great. It was theater. It was imagining a world, imagining something impossible. And we can, this is the artist's world, we can impassion ourselves with the impossible. So that conception of a new world to create a world closer to our heart's desire is very much an artistic impulse. So in worlding, in creating worlds, in visualizing worlds, whether they be aquatic or in the digital sphere, in gaming as a gaming creator, as kind of a historian, as you are, Linda, in a sense, and formulator of technology, how would you position the creation of worlds?
Yeah, I guess I'll take a stab at this. I think Ian probably wants to weigh in on this as well. But I actually wrote a chapter recently on world building, at least within game design discourse. And I think one of the points I tried to make was that a lot of the kind of conceptual and practical difficulties on that level of game design actually map onto these kind of more ecocentric or biocentric tensions that we have to navigate. Questions around who or what gets to decide what the system looks like, how it functions, what it values. We've talked about this already today. And whether where do you see worlding arising? Is it in the sort of constraints of the system that are put into place by a designer or by a group of designers or artists or the mechanics of a game? Or is it in the sort of open-ended, unpredictable sociality that is imbued in the game through play? And then more recently, I made a game with a graduate student that is actually about wildlife mitigation techniques. And everyone's always like, oh, but this group actually might be excited about that. So it was called Corridors. It's about the concept of corridors. But I thought that was very educational because the game itself was a failure, I think. I'm proud to admit that, because what makes a game fun is often the sense of mastery and control. And really to do well in this game, you had to do very little or do nothing. So if you think about how do you modify human infrastructure so that other species can flourish, the answer is you turn lights off, you drive slowly, you don't build, or you build otherwise. And so these are things that are sort of antithetical to the typical spirit of play. And so I think that was very instructive, that the most fun that you can have in the game is hitting deer, because the way that my programmer designed it, it wasn't gory at all. So if you hit them, they actually kind of like gently spun off into space, like these ungulate asteroids. And it was actually lovely. Like, it was like, this is the best part of the game, actually. We should make this into its own. and so I've thought about this a lot. And I think I love, we've mentioned a few great quotes, but we've mentioned Haraway, but also Anna Singh, who has a wonderful quote that is that making worlds is not limited to humans. And sort of a reminder that, whether it's in games or any other kind of realm,
that we can explore these things. I like to mention this example of biotic games that were developed at Stanford and now at Arizona State, Ingmar Riedel Cruz's lab, where he actually rigged light microscopes to a touchscreen using Euglena gracilis, like this very simple protist that's light sensitive. And so you could kind of swipe your hand across a touchscreen and create a corresponding light projection on the microscope slide. And then you would see the Euglena kind of recoiling from the light barrier. And they tried various iterations of this, like trap it, right? Where you would try to trap them, you know, in a light barrier. And of course that raised ethical considerations, even for a single-celled organism, where, you know, visitors to the museum felt like a little bit odd about doing that. And so they started to measure audience reaction. And so the reason I love games is because they, you know, not only are these kind of envelope pushing examples out there where you're playing with living organisms, but they also range from things that are very narrative based that make you feel certain kinds of affect, all the way to system simulation based where you can really build in as much complexity or as little complexity as you want. And you know, your planetary, you can think at that planetary scale or you can think at a much smaller scale.
I mean, I kind of think of it as, I mean, take the example of this conference, like, you know, there's the primary game, there's almost like the A plot, you know, in a TV show, which is to have, you know, you're all meeting for this conference, a certain subject matter, like going through the day, the different panels, that's the main game. But for this to really be a world, you would hope that there would be a web of relationships that flourishes as a result of all meeting, that are all the subplots and all the kind of side quests. That they get generated by virtue of trying to focus on this primary game of moving and getting through this conference. And to me, that's a world. A world has to have both those things. Maybe the driest way I've tried to define it is that a world's a web of relations that flourishes around a repeatable game. So like hopefully you have a conference again of a similar manner and a certain set of relationships that were made here continue to flourish in another setting, whether it's online or that's next year. And so I kind of think a world has to have both plot lines in a way, or the potentiality for both. And then you have something that's really inhabitable, that you have like the drama of life, the main thread, and then you have the real stuff of life, all the in-between side quests and the generative who knows what that emerges from just being together. So I think that last thought is that I think more and more a world can be replicated digitally or mediated digitally, and it can make the creation and destruction, the governance and the exiting of developing worlds way faster. So when my kids grow up, I mean, they're gonna be, you know, making, destroying worlds like in an afternoon. And I think this is a beautiful thing.
Robertina, when you go into the aquatic world, I mean, we're in digital media ever since VR and before, we talk about immersion a lot. And this conference, to the extent that there are creative, energetic relationships, it's an immersive experience. But when you go into the aquatic world, how would you describe that world, that experience of immersing yourself into that world?
In my work, I try to always relate to the species, which they are so foreign to us. Like with jellyfish, I was developing a work between 2012 till 2014, and then I developed two different variations of the project out of that research, because sometimes I think that in only one artwork is sometimes hard to represent all the research and everything what is beyond that. So I started to develop lots of sound spaces also, because when we go into the aquatic kind of levels, you know, humans, we are very visual animals, you know, visual is our main thing and then everything else comes. If you go into the water very quickly after 50 meters, you don't see almost nothing. So you start to relate a lot on the sound and on the pressure. So the touch starts to be much more present than we have it here, you know, like, I try to always recreate this immersiveness between my artworks also. So it could be with the sound, it could be with the visual, because it's always different. Every ocean, every sea has a bit of different characteristics. You know, it's like, it's a landscape, you know, also, but it's a seascape. So all these seascapes also have different presentabilities, you know, like you can be either in the forest of kelp or you are in the rocky areas, yes. You know, or for instance, jellyfish, they're like existing in the oceans already for 500, 600. The numbers are questionable because what is actually the time also, you know, this is like time which we decide, but they don't think about this. For them, it's just like existing also there and they have their own kind of systems. For me, starting to work with the jellyfish was like really interesting to also to understand all these kind of biological properties which they have because of the collagen, of this kind of regenerative kind of properties. And here's again this our human desire of understanding somebody else just that we can get the knowledge into us. Sometimes I try to go beyond that, you know, to that project I like to explain also with the words of Paul Celan's poetry, where he said there is also songs to sing beyond human and beyond humankind. And I think that's a very important point of somebody who survived the horrors of the wars, but also to think where we are, you know? Yeah, there's so much to say further, but I hope that we will have tomorrow more time to informal discussions also.
Yeah, and also the communication with aquatic creatures, you know, music is always a wonderful form of communication between species underwater or on the ground, and we respond to bird songs and whale songs and so on. But the other thing about studying these aliens is to use what we discover to help us explore the boundaries of what it means to be a human and to break us as artists and imaginer of worlds, to break us into a new reality for ourselves and an exploration of possibilities and impossibilities. So we need to open this up to the audience questions now for time.
Hi, I run an artist residency at Google, which is focused on ecology and nature. We experiment with technology, and I really align on the use of art and culture as these vehicles, powerful vehicles for engaging with broader audiences. But my question, I guess, comment is, how do we create real world impact? So how do we really engage with broader audiences? Because a lot of the times art and culture can seem quite, I guess, conceptual. You know, it is engaging, but then what is the actual kind of like real, I guess, application of the art? You know, how can we create something that is valuable for anyone, practical? So yeah, I guess it's a comment and a question, but I ask this all the time. So, you know, why art?
In the case of Biosphere 2, briefly, a lot of people were inspired to do art and projects and public projects based on that. Ian, you have quite, you know, your world is in the digital world. What impact would you say that, and you're exhibited wildly and widely, what impact has that had, or could it have, as it grows?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, art is a, you know, form of, it's, you know, art is like the equivalent of a what dreaming is to, you know, stabilizing your own reality. You know, it's a way of kind of groping at things that are maybe too complex or that are troubling to you, but you don't have a simple answer yet. Your conscious mind doesn't have a simple answer. So art, in a way, is at its best a way to start to grope at these questions that involve imagination and nerve. But, you know, when your dad dies, like, are you going to turn to, like, your email for answers? No, you kind of have to turn to art because it's a complex, troubling thing that you don't have an answer for. And you kind of need art in those moments. And so I would say, you know, in a very pragmatic level, like, art has purpose. It's just in those very acute moments that are hard to, you know, even be aware that you need them when you need them. But when you really do need them, they're there for you. So, you know, thank God Shakespeare distilled, like, you know, certain, you know, key tragedies of human existence so that it could help us in those moments that are tragic in our lives.
Do we have any other questions from the audience that, yes?
I guess I would be curious to hear from you, Alenda, about, you mentioned about like in the wildlife corridors, the importance of not doing anything. And I feel like, you know, going back to earlier conversations, so much of like, there's a kind of activeness around world building or even like solving or doing all these things with technology. I'm curious if you could talk more about not doing anything conceptually, both in the wildlife corridors and then also how it relates to it as a kind of cultural practice, maybe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we could link this to slow movements or to degrowth that we've already talked about. And I think within digital technology and games in particular, this is something that's also coming up now, which is learning to think about constraint in our consumption patterns and also infrastructural needs, but it's not a very popular sell. So there are people who are trying to measure, for instance, the carbon footprint of streaming and who have done some, you know, trying to compare it. I think it's around 1% of emissions, which is comparable to like Shell for like, you know, high quality video on demand streaming, right? So so there's a scholar, Laura Marks, who says, you know, 4K video streaming should, you know, the choice to consume that is somewhat similar to choosing to consume, you know, filet mignon. And so sort of thinking about that kind of stuff has definitely been part of thinking. And then I think that at least within games, there's a whole new genre that's kind of coming up now in indie games and queer games that are generally about playing against the grain of dominant sort of paradigms within gaming, which are often about action and control or total system understanding or competition, that are about these different kinds of modalities, which I find really interesting, and that it's okay to be bored and to not have fun and to have these other kinds of experiences alongside the other kinds as well. So thanks.
The organizing panel, moderated by Johannes Vogel, delved into contentious issues of rights for non-humans and how this territory may evolve.
We have to find a way, we have to articulate a reality within that there is no planet B, but there is also no space outside capitalism right now, so we have to make do.
Can or should we apply human-centric notions such as democracy to non-human animals?
Is something that I think we need to challenge. Now, is that possible through technology? I think technology is not the solution for it, but it is a space at the moment in which a lot of innovation on how we could do that is happening, and I think particularly with women.
We also explored the role that technology can have in this space and the challenges and opportunities that that could afford. In the following extract from the panel, you hear Amelia Winger-Bearskin, Andrea Leiter, Klaus Gutenbrauer and Benjamin Bratton consider the notion of rights for non-human life, respectively.
So we have really a very powerful panel here, and perhaps, Amelia, you can start off with what you feel about the rights of the non-human world.
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I'm indigenous to what is the so-called United States of America. And the notion of a separation of rights between our kin, and I mean our kin that are non-humans and humans, animals, plants, rocks, our sky, our weather pattern, we describe each of these as our kin. We have names for them that are grandmother, that are uncle, that are aunt. We're deeply connected. We are related. They are our nuclear family, right? Only a very short amount of time have these been separated. And that short amount of time was the introduction, the advent of colonial thought into what is now the Americas. And I'm so inspired to hear so many people today at this incredible interspecies summit who are talking about this interconnectedness, this reliability we have on all of the systems that we are a part of. Just yesterday, I was on top of a 700-foot cliff, just with my legs dangling over the ocean in Mendocino, California. And I thought about this planet, this blue marble, you know, that we see from a million miles away. It looks just like one beautiful blue dot with no water system that separates us. And I imagine looking over into that ocean, how insane it is to imagine that we have supremacy over nature, that we and our ways of thinking have supremacy over nature, over animals, and over thought, and that we are not its kin, we are not deeply interconnected with it. And so I know we had a lot of sort of email-like planning of this panel and going a little bit of back and forth about thinking of, you know, personifying or animism or understanding animals as humans. And it definitely seems to me as though we need to place side by side our intelligence, or possibly beneath that of what we understand it as part of our world. So I think before we can talk about rights, we should also understand the type of rights that we have been bestowed and given by the beautiful kin that we have as nature. They have given us rights. And so what is it to us to reciprocate this gift of life? And it is required of us to reciprocate that gift.
I would like to hark into what Amelia started with by saying that thinking of something like digital rights might be a good avenue, because it might open up a little bit of space from understanding rights purely as something, we can call it Westphalian, we can call it the modern nation state, we can call it whatever we want to call it, but that sense of a right-giving central entity which gives rights out in a form that operates like a cookie cutter and says object, subject, object, subject, and goes around like this, and everything has to be fit into these forms of rights. Because I think that with that sense, I mean, without there are a lot of efforts in rights of nature like that, and the question becomes, how would then a river speak? Usually mediated through custodians, human custodians who speak in that interest. And then I think that what becomes interesting by thinking through maybe something like digital rights or technologically mediated rights is that at least for a moment, this question is bracketed and opened up into a different direction to say, what should these digital rights do? What are they supposed to achieve rather than what is their form and how does it work? And so I think that this is something where, let's say, with the work that that the Sovereign Nature Initiative is trying to do a little bit, the idea of value as it was invoked today a number of times, both as a question of what do we value, but also as a matter of question of, there was a question on capitalism that was bracketed to another yeah. day, maybe to just bring it a little bit in, really the question of value in both an economic sense, but also in the way of how we know and how we understand, is something that I think we need to challenge. Now, is that possible through technology? I think technology is not the solution for it, but it is a space at the moment in which a lot of innovation on how we could do that is happening. And I think particularly with Web3, what is interesting to me and to the Sovereign Nature Initiative is that we try to move as far away as we can from a universal understanding of value that also came up a number of times today of how can we have a shared value. And I think that it was, as it was also said before today, it's not about this shared value. It's precisely not the cookie cutter. It's trying to get away from the cookie cutter. And so I think when it comes to different modes of governance, of decentralized governance, of decentralized ways of expressing what matters and what is valuable, I think Web3 technologies have opened up interesting ways to connect differently and to work differently. Not to say technology is the solution to that at all, but it is maybe the way of unlocking and reconfiguring some of these questions in interesting ways.
I would say actually rights and the legal system is also one of those technologies, one that precedes digital technologies. So I feel the goal of rights of nature seems to be environmental protection, which in a way sits in the middle of the problem, like indeed in the capitalist logic, as though it builds on, I think as you address also, it builds on the separation of nature and the human world, which is itself the problem. So even like to articulate rights is a way to kind of overcome that, but it's also predicated on the separation that is also kind of kept in place by it. So I feel it's a brave attempt, and it works in certain contexts. It works to protect certain areas that are sometimes granted legal personhood, but like in the case of Ecuador, that made the constitutional move where nature is considered like the base of reality And it calls everybody who feels the need to act on behalf of particular bodies within the ecosphere of Ecuador that need protection to come forth and protect it. So again, yeah, this the rights approach is brave within a certain system. At the same time, it also holds it a little bit in place. And I think this is the problem that I feel we need to address when we talk about interspecies. We have to find a way, we have to articulate a reality within, there is no planet B, but there are also no space outside capitalism right now. So we have to make do inside of it. But we try to articulate a reality that does not codify the rights of non-humans, but treats them as though they have these rights already. That actually what is necessary is to find a way to collaborate. So I'm not sure if it's actually justified to call this a rights approach. It in a way bypasses the logic of rights. It says what is needed is a practice of committed collaboration, of creating space, of allowing all other beings next to humans to express their own needs and find a way to find a convivial way of living.
Okay. Benjamin, what's your point of view to this? Because I think it might be different.
I really like something that one of the other panelists had said earlier about that the important question is perhaps less about what rights are than what rights do. I think might be an interesting way to focus this conversation and might connect in some respects to what Klaus had just suggested about rights as a kind of technology. That thinking about these sort of legal systems as nominative systems, enforcement systems, as technological systems in their own right, which would lead us to think a bit about the artificiality of rights and the artificiality of the identification of rights in ways that I think might actually be quite productive for the conversation. I guess one of my concerns I'll just sort of raise here in a certain sense is the risk that the expansion of the rights discourse may involve a kind of anthropomorphization of forms of life that have a kind of way of being and way of dignity that is not human-like and doesn't deserve this level of anthropomorphization. One of the ways in which this can sometimes take place is through the projection of personhood onto things that are viable and dignified forms of life, but may or may not be people in the way in which we think about this. In other words, there's a kind of tricky dynamic between understanding animals as humans on the one hand and humans as animals. My perspective is one in which we need to emphasize the question of humans as animals. I suppose in a certain sense, then the way in which I would approach this sort of breaks down between a kind of practical question and a philosophical one. And in general, I'm much more comfortable with the practical issues of using discourses of rights, technologies of rights, for purposes of the protection of ecosystems, watersheds, species, other kinds of things, than I am with some of the philosophical claims that might be made through it. I would remind the panel that we already have lots of forms of non-human entities that have legal rights, namely the corporations that Klaus had recently identified. And so that the technical structure by which we might identify and imbue non-humans with rights in and of itself is not necessarily the deus ex machina. All of which sort of leads me to conclude is that I think what we would want to do is to kind of embrace the artificiality of this as a construction. That is, instead of seeing rights as something that is naturally given, and that simply we need to bend a legal or political system to represent, to actually understand rights as an artificial construction, and that the composability of a rights regime as an artificial construction, I think will allow for much more the kinds of practical effects that we're all interested in terms of what rights do. Thank you.
This podcast is produced on the occasion of the Interspecies Future Symposium in July 2022, co-hosted by Light Art Space and the Museum for Natakunda in Berlin. The symposium has been orchestrated and convened by the chairs, Kenrick Aledo-McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard, with Bettina Carmes and Johannes Vogel. The wider programme has been curated by Light Artspace Head of Programmes Amira Gad, with Corinne Minat as co-organiser of the Interspecies Future Symposium and surrounding activities. This series is produced and hosted by me, Bridie Addison-Child. It is a reduced listening production supported by Light Artspace.